Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour, top of the morning to you, or top of the afternoon, as the case may be, wherever you may be. Strange goings on around the world. By the way, our quote for the day, conservative is a man with two perfectly good legs who, however, has never learned how to walk forward. That from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the U.S. President of the United States. Also in today's program, in our Taking Our Country Back segment, Kimmon Kotos is going to be here, a progressive running for Congress in Michigan's 2nd District. Right now we have with us the Reverend David Berman. He's a minister, a fully ordained Christian minister, and the author of a book, Wake Up and Smell the Truth. His website, Rev Berman, R-E-V-Berman, B-E-R-M-A-N .com. Reverend Berman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Promotion of you to talk show hosts, I guess, is the only way I could describe this, is immigration has become a hot-button topic in Washington and all over the country. Get a fresh and shocking perspective on this issue by talking with Reverend David Berman, who will explain his uncensored views on why people coming to America should change to our way of life or get out of our country. What do you mean by that?
I mean exactly what I said. This is a country that is unique. It is based on constitutional principles. And if you come to America, you should not be coming here just because you want to come to the land, but rather you want to assimilate into our basic constitutional view of life and the principles on which this nation was founded on.
Do you see anybody coming here who doesn't want to? I mean, for example, my sister-in-law is becoming a U.S. citizen right now. She wants to be a U.S. citizen. I mean, it's going to be like a 6-year process.
Yeah, well, because she's coming here legally, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the issue. And mainly we're talking about illegal immigrants that come in that are looking to get a job, which I certainly understand their desire to get a job. But the problem is that we're a nation of laws, not men. And the laws must be respected. So if you come into the country as an illegal immigrant, you're not really coming here obeying the laws in the first place. And so if you're immigrating to this country on a beta laws and you ought to desire to become a citizen, and that means you go through the process of learning our principles so you're assimilated into our way of life. If you don't want to be assimilated into our way of life, then you need not come here.
But isn't that essentially what the Democrats are suggesting, when, and for that matter, what President Bush is suggesting, let's offer a path for citizenship to folks who want to become citizens?
No, because they're offering, I completely disagree with President Bush and the Democrats, and giving any type of reward for those who have broken the law. There are people, like you said, your sister or your sister-in-law, I forgot what you said.
Sister-in-law.
And your sister-in-law is obeying the law, coming here, obeying the law, and showing respect for this nation, and I welcome her in the nation. But those who have not shown respect for this nation's laws should not be given any kind of pass to citizenship. They should be sent back where they came from because they're the breakers of laws.
David Berman, I agree with you. However, I disagree with the Democrats, frankly. I think an amnesty program is the wrong thing. And I know a lot of my friends on the quote, the left, end quote, disagree with me on that. But a startling number agree. But here's where I suspect we part company. I don't see this as a problem of illegal immigration. We have had essentially an open border with Mexico and with Canada for the entire existence of this country. I mean, you know, the border with Mexico, of course, has moved around over the years, but nonetheless, there's been an open border there functionally forever. And we have never had an illegal immigration problem until in the 1980s, Reagan essentially stopped enforcing any meaningful sanctions against employers. In 1986, pushed through an amnesty, which was basically a, hey, let me get your attention. Hey, there's an opportunity here. Come on up here. You can make our companies more profitable. And what we have now in the United States, and we're down to 3 prosecutions of companies last year under the Bush administration. We have an illegal employer problem in this country, not an illegal immigration problem.
Well, let me say to you that, you know, I know that I'm a conservative, And you and I are going to disagree on a lot of issues, but on this one we'll agree. And I loved Ronald Reagan, but he was wrong about that. And I think it's important not to be a partisan on either side. I'm not a partisan. I'm a conservative. You know, you tend to be, I guess, more liberal than I am. But I appreciate you saying you don't agree with the Democrats on some things. And I don't agree with Bush on this. I don't agree with Ronald Reagan did either. And I certainly don't agree with the lack of prosecutions of the companies that are hiring illegal immigrants. And that's one of the points that I make. You've got to penalize these companies severely for hiring people who are not legally here. And if you do that, you will dry up those jobs to the illegals, and then people who are here legally, who are either citizens or are here legally, will have the opportunity for those jobs.
But here's the two things that I'm, in my mind, folks who are arguing your position, and I'm not putting words in your mouth. I mean, I'll give you a chance to say what, you know, your response to this is. I'm sorry, I just got distracted there. The things that folks on your side are arguing is are by and large, number one, that the people themselves who are coming into the United States should be the focus of our attention, that they should be made criminals. And I agree with you. They've already broken the law. They haven't committed a felony, however, that they should be made felons. And number two, who would say, and this is where, as a Christian minister, I'm really curious to get your take on it, who would say that anybody who helps them, who does what essentially Jesus did with the Samaritan, or the guy that the Samaritan eventually helped, the guy who was on the road, that should become criminals as well. And they don't want to talk about the employers, the illegal employers in the United States, and they don't want to talk about this as an illegal employer problem, because the illegal employers are providing massive amounts of money, both to the Republican Party and via the Republican Party, to the religious right.
Well, I don't know about the whole religious right conspiracy thing, but...
Well, the religious right got $1 billion from the Bush administration last year. This is a program that was never even passed by Congress, didn't exist until George Bush came into office. $1 billion in an election year is an awful lot of money to be handing to one particular constituent.
Oh, you're talking about a faith-based initiative?
That's right.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other issue, but the bottom line here is that as a Christian minister, the question does come to me, well, shouldn't we help everybody? And the answer is, no, we shouldn't, because it's not possible to help everybody. If you kill the goose that laid the golden egg, you're not going to get any more eggs anymore.
So you would have walked by the guy on the road to wherever the road was.
No, that's a completely different issue. See, that has nothing whatsoever to do with somebody breaking the law, coming into the country in mass amounts, and then having people employ them illegally.
But that guy was...
I'd love to have an opportunity to answer.
But the point is, that guy was a member of a group that was viewed as undesirable, you know, not, I'm forgetting the collection, it's been a while since, but, you know, he was viewed.
And let me say to you that I go to Mexico and feed hungry children. So there's no debate here as to whether or not I think people should be helped.
But you would be unwilling to feed a hungry Mexican if they were here illegally.
I would be happy to feed anybody or to give anybody emergency health care if it was a true emergency. I don't think you should allow somebody who's here illegally who's dying to die. Of course not. But here's the real issue. The issue is that if I said to you, and I, you know, I'm sure you're a compassionate guy. You're a compassionate guy, right?
Sure.
Okay, so if I said to you, look, tomorrow there's 500 people that are going to come to your house and live in your house and on your property. You would say, hold on a minute. I might be compassionate about those 500 people, but I really can't have them live on my property. And what if they said to you, well, too bad, we're going to live there anyway? You'd say, well, hold on a second.
Yeah, now, we're doing apples and oranges here, though, David Byrne. I mean, what I'm saying is that if we prosecute the employers, most of these folks are just going to leave. And I'm not an advocate of government programs for people who are illegal aliens. Although, again, I don't think that, you know, if somebody is sick or hungry, they should be allowed to die or starve. But that, you know, that said,
we don't disagree on that.
Okay, I suspect we're saying the same thing then.
No, I think the bottom line is to equate saying that people ought to follow the law with being uncompassionate is not a fair equation. Now, if someone says, well, we're going to take them in and give sanctuary to them when they're not. I'm not talking about someone who's dying, but then that's breaking the law, and they should be prosecuted.
Well, and that's helping out the illegal employers, really. That's, I have a concern with that too, and that, you know, giving sanctuary to people who are here because they want to have they want to work for an illegal employer is, you know, I have a problem with it. I just,
well, see, you, the only difference that you and I have is that you put all of the responsibility on an employer. I put it on both.
Well, see, I just know.
Yeah, I'm ridiculous.
I'm not going to argue with you on that. Reverend David Berman, RevBerman.com is website. Gee, I thought we'd have a better fight than that, but good
I'd
talking with you. Okay, we'll do it some other time on something else. Maybe the minimum wage. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And when the winds of empire have blown...
523-6620. 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less, because we'd like to hear from you. 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count. 503-323-6620. Another public service from the Tom Hartman Radio Program. In fact, here, a comment from a listener...
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to, this is Logan from New York City, I just wanted to make the point that the Democrats have to really come back with a rejoinder to this claim that they're, that the press is endangering national security by leaking. This leaking wouldn't be necessary if the Bush administration would follow the proper procedure. That way there would be nothing to leak, and therefore these programs would stay under wraps and be much more effective than they are currently now.
Yeah, well said, Logan. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Louise comments, these guys are really slick. In print, this guy that I just had on, in print he says, oh, these people are terrible, and it's, you know, basically the brown hordes coming to get us. And then on the air, they're like, These are folks looking for a decent job. These are not evil people. I'm sorry. I'm not willing to demonize people who are coming across the border illegally. I'll acknowledge it's illegally. Who are coming across the border looking for a job. I am willing to demonize the people who are saying to them, hey, come across the border and we'll give you a job. I mean, that is just wrong. It's just plain old, flat out wrong. And you know, we can't have it happen. 1-866-440-8466. Mina in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Mina, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I get so upset when people keep saying illegal aliens. If we called them undocumented aliens, we'd get rid of the buzzword illegal. And where is Reverend Berman's anger at the Bush administration for breaking the law and illegally wiretapping Americans since February of 2001? And
yeah,
nobody says anything about that.
See, that's not one of these wedge issues that they can drag the religious right out to scream and wave the flag about. I mean,
see, I kind of call people like Reverend Berman the Christian Taliban, because he's to the Christian religion what the Taliban is to the Muslim religion.
Yeah, I can't speak directly to him because I don't know enough about him to, and I certainly wouldn't want to, you know, personalize this to him, but there very much is a Christian Taliban out there. And Michelle Goldberg has written a brilliant book about it called Kingdom Coming, which is going to be our book of the month on BuzzFlash this week.
Okay.
In fact, I think it goes up today.
Okay.
It's amazing.
I'd like to tell you one quick thing. Dick Cheney was in Grand Island, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And Central Nebraska Peaceworkers.org organized a demonstration across the street from the hotel he was at, and they let us be there. And we had 25 people. Four of them came down from South Dakota.
Wow, that's great. That's great. So, well, good on you, Mina.
Thank you.
Activism begins with you, and you did it. Good on you. Thanks a lot for the call. Virginia in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Just wanted to comment and go back a little bit to the undocumented and the problem being with the employers. It always amazes me that we create a system that encourages people to abuse it. We're amazed that they abuse it. Our very own welfare system is structured in such a way that we really, I mean, you'd have to be stupid to come off and get
well. I strongly disagree with you on that, Virginia, these days, because you can't, it's very, very difficult to live on what's available through welfare now. Bill Clinton's so-called reform of welfare has dramatically increased over the years now as a consequence of it. You know, you've got to go back to work. But by the way, we're not going to provide you with child care help, even though you have children.
Support you need to do that. And the employers expect building and they will come. If the employers were punished for hiring people for the jobs Americans won't do, well, they won't do them because they can't afford to do them because they're paying them below minimum.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. I mean, it's very simply the bottom line. People say, oh, Americans won't do these jobs. Come on, give me a break. Americans will do anything and have throughout the history of America. You just have to pay them a decent salary for it. Go back and look at the old Jackie Gleason show from when I was a kid in the late 50s, early 60s. And Ralph Cramden, you know, his neighbor. What did he do? He worked in the sewers of New York City. I mean, there's no such thing as a job an American won't do, period. It's just, Virginia, thanks for the call. Nancy in Olympia. Hey, Nancy, we have about a half a minute here before we've got to wrap this segment up. What's up?
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about the fact that I grew up in Southern California and I moved to Olympia about 12 or so years ago, 13, something like that. And I recently went back for a visit for a week, and I was utterly shocked and amazed at everywhere there's nothing but Mexicans doing all the work, gardening, construction, freeway, everything. It was only Mexicans. And we even went into a Mervyn's in Southern California, and they, right by where I used to live, in Upland, excuse me, and it was their announcements were only in Spanish. They weren't Spanish and English, which wouldn't have been quite as bad, but only they're over the speaker.
And this is, Nancy, this is where we need to distinguish. I'm assuming that your concern is not, oh, my God, it's brown people who speak Spanish, but rather it's people who are competing for our jobs, or am I getting this wrong?
Exactly. They're taking our jobs, and they're taking over.
Yeah.
And they're not here illegally, and it's very shocking to me, being away for as long as I was.
Nancy, thanks for the call. I've got to go. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Some people look for saints, for saviors from above. Some people look for justice, or for everlasting life. Whatever way you go, corporations like a track. We're way too deep in corporate hell. There ain't no turning back.
It's the bottom line, shame. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Our toll-free number all across the United States, 866-440-8466. This from the Associated Press. Millions of oranges will rot on the trees of Florida this year because a shortage of fruit pickers has been aggravated by fears about more stringent U.S. immigration laws, local media reported yesterday. This is fascinating. The media is reporting and opining. You get this? The media here is offering both a fact and an opinion. Now, I would offer a different opinion. I'd say the reason why there's a shortage of fruit pickers is not because people are concerned about U.S. immigration laws, because I'm not seeing any decrease in people trying to illegally cross the border or in any increase in people heading back south across the border, which is fairly easy to do. You just show up and say, hi, here I am, I'm leaving. You don't have to cross the desert to get back out again. You can just go through the checkpoint down there and there's a whole variety of them. I would say that the reason why there's a shortage of fruit pickers is because there are employers who will employ illegal aliens outside of the agricultural industry, which has traditionally been the haven where we've all, as Americans, kind of winked and nodded and said, yeah, we want to have cheap food, so we'll allow the modern-day version of slave labor. Or you could argue entry level labor. I don't know what you want to argue it. Because you could argue this in a variety of different ways. But in any case, we'll allow that in the in the agricultural industry, although it was, these were real jobs at one time for people. Dennis Weaver, the actor, I wrote the foreword to his autobiography, The Whole World's a Stage, All the World's a Stage. And it's an amazing book. I encourage you to get it and read it, assuming it's still in print. Dennis died a few months ago, in fact, last time I talked to him was just last year, just before he died. And he, as a kid, moved with his family up to Oregon to pick strawberries. I mean, they were picking strawberries, him and his brother and his sister and his mother. They were migrant farm workers. This was in the 1930s. And so, I mean, there was a time when Americans were doing those jobs. And then we had a bit of a labor shortage during World War II and brought in immigrant labor. And ever since then, we've been kind of winking and nodding about that. Well, what's happened is that increasingly we've said, well, those folks who were picking fruit before, for $5 an hour or $3 an hour or whatever, a dollar an hour, well, now instead of paying union carpenters $25 an hour plus benefits, we'll pay those people $9 an hour to do carpentry work or $10 an hour. And I would say that that's the reason why there's a shortage of fruit pickers, because the people who were picking fruit 5 years ago are now building houses. They're now working in factories. They're now working in meat packing plants. They're now doing things that were being done by legal citizens of the United States. We're seeing a shift, a qualitative shift in the nature of labor. There was an article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine this weekend in which two economists, one saying illegal immigration is reducing the standard of living and mostly hurting the poor, which is kind of common sense, and the other saying, no, illegal immigration is just fine because these people immigrate into a society and they end up becoming consumers, which is true if you look at a static moment. And in fact, his example was a static moment. He was looking at Miami, and he was saying, well, look at Miami. You had the Mariel boat lift, and you had all these, you had 100,000 Cubans come in who represented about 10% of the population of Miami. And yes, over the short period of time, there was a depression of wages, but within a year or so, everything was back to normal. In fact, things were even better. And I'm sure his study was right. I'm sure his science was right. The problem is that we don't have in the United States, relative to the countries south of us right now, a group of people coming into the United States, staying here, becoming permanent members of our society, and that's it, like with the Mariel boat lift. Instead, we have a continuous flow. And I was just amazed that the New York Times published this article that was comparing these one-up situations where you get this burp, you get this sudden influx of immigrants, where they were actually looking for these one-up experiments. We could say, okay, there's a sudden influx of immigrants into an area. What consequence does it have? And let's look at it over a few-year period. When the real situation that we're facing in the United States is a continuous flow, what would you do? Do away with the border? And then be a permanent release valve for all the problems that are happening in Mexico? And this... what we need to be doing is, number one, changing our trade policies, number two, changing our agricultural and agricultural subsidy policies so that we're not whacking the people of South and Central America, and number two, stop, you know, make it illegal to hire them. So anyway, this article, Mike Carlton, director and producer of labor affairs at Florida Citrus Mutual, told the newspaper The Ledger, there's very little doubt we'll leave a significant amount of fruit on the trees. Whether it's 3 million or 6 million boxes, nobody can say. Growers have reported difficulty finding enough workers. Industry officials say labor problems got worse in the middle of May when a large segment of the Hispanic labor force seemed to leave the state. They said reports of an immigration crackdown made it difficult to find Hispanic workers who make up much of Florida's farm workforce. Well, I would suggest that they've gone someplace else in the United States to get real jobs. Not to say, picking fruit is not a real job. I did it once. It's not just a real job. It's hard work. But I picked apples. I didn't pick oranges. But in any case, Michael in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Michael, your thoughts on all this?
Hello, Tom?
Yeah, Michael, you're live and on the air.
Thanks.
And thanks for thanks for listening there at WVAA, isn't it, in Burlington?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just calling about Nancy from Upland, California.
Right. Well, actually, she was from Washington. She grew up in Southern California and went back to it, yeah.
Right. As long as I can remember, Southern California, that part of Southern California, which is Riverside County, has been like one of the most heavily populated Hispanic areas in Southern California, even more so than like East Hollywood, which is years ago. But now there's Rancho Cucamonga. How English is that one? Isn't it right next to Upland? And it's mostly Hispanic. Riverside County is mostly Hispanic. Ontario Airport expanded hugely. And what they're seeing is, people moving out of L.A. that can't, the white Anglo people moving out of L.A. who can't afford to live. And those prices have moved out into these areas, which before were pretty much, Hispanic.
So it's sort of gentrification and reverse gentrification. And where the conversation starts getting really weird is when people start talking about this as if it's a race issue or even a culture issue, frankly.
Exactly.
I have problems with both of those. I'm just looking at the economics of it.
Exactly. And to say, look and say, oh, well, everyone there's Hispanic. Well, yeah, go to the Nordstrom's at the mall next town over from Upland, not Rancho Cucamonga. The other way, guess what? They won't speak Spanish.
Yeah, or just imagine that you're an actual American, and there's a sordid history to probably most of the dimensions of it. But the reality, I think, that we have to focus on right now is that the American middle class, the American middle class of all races, the American middle class, broadly speaking, from the working poor to the working doing fairly well, but basically the American middle class is under assault. It's under assault by conservatives, and that assault is taking three forms. Number one, trade policies that export our industries. The elimination of tariffs and the replacement of those tariffs with so-called global free trade. The Tom Friedman, Milton Friedman, Bill Clinton, frankly, WTO, GATT, NAFTA. That's the lead part of the assault on the middle class. Number two, tearing down labor unions. The starting with the Reagan administration, an organized war against labor unions and turning the National Labor Relations Board from a pro-labor agency as it was envisioned in the legislation, the Wagner Act in 1935 that created it, into an anti-labor organization. And number three, increasing the labor force by encouraging illegal immigration into the United States.
Right. I agree.
And it has to be viewed as a whole thing. It encompasses all three of those. Immigration is only a piece of it. I doubt it's even a third of it. I don't think it's a big piece of it, but it's a piece of it, and we have to acknowledge that, and we have to have some kind of rational policy that doesn't get hysterical, that isn't racist, and that doesn't encourage the kind of racist, hyperbolic, over-the-top, white nationalist type of rhetoric that tragically the whole immigration debate is encouraging. I mean, the reason why the Republicans think that they're going to win with this thing in 2006, and frankly, I think in a lot of America they will, and just look at the Busby race as an example, is because they're doing the Willie Horton thing all over again. They're not going to play it. Like, they're not going to play it straight. They're not going to play it honest. I mean, the Willie Horton ad was not an honest and straight ad. They're going to play it as brown people are out to get you. Be afraid, be very afraid.
That's right. And if you look at anyone that's brown, they must be an illegal immigrant.
Right. And which is wrong, A, nuts, B. I mean, it's another variation on the other race card that the Bush administration and all the cons are playing, which is if you're brown and you don't look like you're from South America, you look like you're from the Middle East, you must be a terrorist.
Right.
And, I'm telling you, these guys, they're going to be clobbering us with this stuff. And it's going to be more and more of this be afraid, be very afraid stuff. And it's not good for America. And the Democratic Party better get ready for it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
While you're strolling down the fairway, showing no remorse, growing from the poisons they've sprayed on your golf course. While you're busy sinking birdies and keeping your scorecard, the devil's been busy in your backyard.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. See, the cons are setting this thing up to become essentially code words for racism in the fall election. Let me just tell you that in advance. Just like Bush Sr. did with Willie Horton and going up against Dukakis, the Willie Horton ads were essentially code phrases for, oh, those black people, they support Michael Dukakis. They're going to come and get you. I mean, that was the bottom line of Bush Sr. ads, the Lee Atwater ads. And they're fixing to do it again. You got John Gibson on Fox News out there saying to white people have to have more babies. I mean, they're setting this thing up.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies. That's the lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, a story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities.
Uh-oh.
Far, the greatest number are Hispanic.
Uh-oh.
Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer.
And John Gibson's very worried about this.
Put it bluntly, we need more babies. Forget about that zero population growth stuff that my poor generation was misled on. Why is this important? Because civilizations need population to survive.
We need white people.
So far, we're doing our part here in America, but Hispanics can't carry the whole load. The rest of you get busy. Make babies. Or put another way, a slogan for our times, procreation, not recreation. That's my word.
Yeah, John Gibson on Fox News with an editorial comment. Right. John in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hey, you're live and on the air. What's up?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, John. I was laughing at John Gibson. Boy, that's a racist thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little strange. I'm amazed that Fox let him get away with it, and I'm amazed that there wasn't more backlash against him for it. But the rest of the media just completely ignored it. So I'm telling you, this is they're setting this thing up.
That's fair and balanced. Didn't you know that?
There you go.
I called to reiterate what you were saying about the immigrants going to different jobs. You know, I drive trucks for a living, and I go to a lot of these warehouses and businesses, and I would say that probably a lot of them, probably 80% of them are migrant, or I can't say migrant, but I would say Latin-speaking people in these warehouses. And I mean, I'm talking about all over the country. I think they're getting smart and leaving the farms and going to the factories and the warehouses. I think that they're seeing that there's better jobs in that area.
Sure. Because there are employers who are willing to break the law and hire them.
Sure, exactly. And I want to leave you with one more thought, and that was that I think that this country will culturally change probably within the next 20 years. And I'm talking about Congress and everything. I think that as time goes on and citizenship becomes more, I think that Congress is going to change also.
Well, I expect that America is going to become more and more Hispanic, shall we say. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I mean, America has gone through a whole series of cultural transformations. You know, we were very anti-Italian and anti-Irish for, you know, the early part of the 1800s. And then, you know, waves of immigrants came in and they were discriminated against. And now they're us, right?
I agree with you. I think most Americans don't have a problem with people wanting to come to this country and make a niche in their life to make their lives better. I think where most Americans have the problem is that we don't know who's coming in and who's here to hurt us, and that's where the problem lies.
Yeah. And let's do it by the book, and let's do it by the rules.
The politicians that we put into office got to realize that, you know what, as much as you don't want to offend anybody, you got to force some rules. They're, you know, they're breaking the law. Let's start it off by saying that they're just coming in here in periods. They're starting off by breaking the law.
Yeah,
you know, you want to
it is...
Away.
Yeah, and it is the employers. Let's keep it first and foremost. It's the employers who are breaking. It's like with drugs. I mean, it's silly to go after drug users. Go after the pushers. Go after the people who are importing the stuff into the country. If you want to enforce drug laws, I think drug laws are silly to begin with, but that's a whole other thing. Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hey, Brian.
Hey, no, let's not forget that Ronald Reagan and his welfare queen's comment. We know where that was.
Right, and there was no such person. The entire Republican Party was unable to produce even one person on welfare who used a Cadillac to get their welfare check. Never was able to find one. But Reagan, that got repeated so many times, people actually came to believe it.
Well, you know, the Republicans are very good at when you try to point out the that they're trying to destroy the middle class and that people should be allowed to make a living wage and that, you know, you don't have a real economy if you don't have a middle class. They, you know, accuse you of being a socialist, a populist, and
You want to redistribute income, don't you, Brian?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, we need to figure out a way to not let people kind of fall into that or let them be succumbed by that, you know, argument.
I absolutely agree. Brian, I got to move along, but point well made. We have 1 minute left. Mike in Port Orchard, Washington.
Hi, I want to make a comment about the immigration bill out of the Senate.
And that, in my opinion, what's really wrong with that bill, there's two things that are really wrong with it, and one of those is the guest worker aspect of it.
Right, it's a reinvention of the old Bracero program. It's indentured servitude.
That's just an indentured servitude thing, and that's what kicks the hell out of wages.
Yep.
So
yep.
There's Absolutely. One. The other one is their thing about assessing fines against these people, and the thing to do is to just say, well, you know, you the money you put into the Social Security stuff is gone.
Yeah.
That's enough. That's
yeah,
enough.
And you don't have a job. and thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's tragic to see how the Republicans are going to use this issue to bring out the racists, bring out the xenophobes. They've already gone after the homophobes. They've got, in all but five states or something, anti-gay legislation passed, and there'll be more. But, you know, they have to have an enemy because they have nothing to offer positive. The Republicans have virtually nothing positive to offer. Everything has to be what they're against. And it's a tragedy. It's really a tragedy. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, believe it or not, Ken Lay was compared to Jesus at his funeral. In the meantime, a British banker who was questioned by U.S. authorities, this is some Yahoo News, by U.S. authorities in connection with the Enron scandal, has been found dead. He'd been questioned by the FBI in the case of three British bankers facing Enron-related fraud charges. Police would not immediately say how he died, but homicide officers were investigating standard procedure in all suspicious deaths. These three former bankers with National Westminster Bank, owned by the Royal Bank of Scotland, are going to be extradited in all probability today to the United States. And apparently the guy who set him up, it looks like his name is Neil Colbeck. Royal Bank of Scotland sent condolences to him, although the British have not released his name. He's dead. He's dead. He's kaput. So, let's see. Bill Casey, he had the goods on Bush Sr., and just before he's supposed to testify, he suddenly has a seizure and the side of his brain that controls speech and gets taken into the hospital and operated on, and isn't that strange? And then you got Ken Lay, and he's convicted, and so now he's negotiating for, what can I offer? What can I talk about? And he dies, and here's another one. Norman sent me this note. He said, John Mills, executive director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, died a day after he forced the CIA to release a controversial report dealing with cocaine trafficking. He committed suicide on June 4th, 2000. The committee had their meeting on June 3rd. That would have been cocaine trafficking by the Reagan-Bush administration. And then, of course, there was former White House counsel Charles Ruff. He was reportedly briefed on the HPSCI findings by Mills. He died on December 20th of a, quote, apparent heart attack, end quote. A few weeks after his death, the person that he had briefed, Representative Julian Dixon, on the HPSCI report about the involvement of Bush Sr. in cocaine trafficking and an Iran-Contra, quote, died suddenly of an apparent heart attack on December 8th, 2000. He says, I wonder how who's next? He says, this information and more, by the way, is in Wayne Madsen's book, Jaded Task, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. Interesting stuff. You know, who's next? Where is it going to go around? What's it going to go around? I had an email from a physician who also said, you know, we always I was at a medical conference, and folks were talking about, wasn't that strange that they took out that part of Bill Casey's brain where he's able to speak? You know, why? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And this guy was a neurologist. Very strange. Anyhow, that's in the news. Thought you'd want to know. By the way, hey, good news. I made 86 cents. Yep, sure enough. Marriott International, biggest U.S. hotel operator, said second quarter profit jumped 35% on increased prices and management fees. And to the extent that I am a member of the class of people who make their living sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, I do get dividend checks from Marriott. Back 15 years ago or so, I was making a good chunk of my living as a consultant, traveling around the country, doing trainings and doing consulting work with companies, and mostly companies, some government agencies as well, in marketing, advertising, public speaking, that kind of thing. And Marriott at the time was offering a 10% discount if you were a stockholder. So I bought one share of Marriott stock. It cost me like $23, as I recall. Well, the stock is up to like $37 now, and it's split, so I have more than two shares. Plus, I've told them to reinvest my dividends. I used to be getting these checks. Every 3 months, I'd get a check for like 8 cents. And the first couple ones, I thought, that's kind of a cool souvenir. Here's my 8 cents check, 9 cent check. Well, it would have been 43 cents a share, and I have 2.2 shares right now, so that would be, you know, what, 86, 90 cents. I just made 90 cents. And what's really cool about it is thanks to the Bush tax cuts, I don't, you know, the maximum amount of income tax that I have to pay on that is 15%, and no Social Security tax. Hey, it's a good gig if you can get it, right? Anyhow, back to the topic at hand and moving on with the program. Tricia in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Tricia, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. One of the things that I haven't heard discussed on the immigration issue is that the more they criminalize people coming to the country illegally, the more it's going to ultimately compromise their right to vote, even if they are nationalized. If they have a felony conviction, they're essentially disenfranchised in 48 of our 50 states.
I could be wrong, Tricia, but I believe that if you are a felon, you cannot be naturalized.
Well, that's another way of, you know, eliminating.
Which produces a strange catch-22, because if, you know, and one of the reasons I think why the folks who are in favor of just essentially mass amnesty want to be sure that illegal immigration is a misdemeanor and not a felony, because if it were a felony, then people would not be eligible for citizenship. I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. I mean, I'm not an immigration attorney, but this is my read of the way it's being dealt with, at least in the popular press.
Well, my concern was that it was might be laying a foundation for, you know, down the road having a, like you said, our country is going, you know, more, you know, towards the Latin population, which, again, I agree, is fine. That maybe it's a way of disenfranchising that group, even if they do jump through the hoop.
Well, the big it could be, Tricia. The big competition right now is between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party for the hearts and minds of Latino voters. The Republicans are doing it smart. They're out there. They are buying time on Spanish language radio stations. A friend of mine actually owns, is in the, let's say he's in the business, the Spanish radio business. And I don't want to out the guy too much. And it's amazing the amount of money that the Republican Party and 503, whatever they are, 502s or whatever, these lobbying agencies that are associated with Republicans, they're buying huge chunks of time to put right-wing talk show hosts on, the Spanish-language versions of Rush Limbaugh, on Spanish-language stations all over the country. And the Republican Party is building a strong infrastructure. And what they're doing is they're going on and they're talking about abortion, because most Hispanics are Catholic. They're talking about God and the flag. They're talking about the Pledge of Allegiance. They are converting new immigrants, both legal and illegal, in the United States. They're converting them into values Republicans, in quote. And they're doing it very aggressively, very methodically, very thoroughly. And the Democrats, on the other hand, are sitting around saying, well, you know, traditionally immigrants vote Democratic. The reason being, of course, traditionally immigrants start out at the bottom of the economic ladder. That is, they're blue-collar workers, and so they're usually union members. But these immigrants, it may be a whole different thing, and the Republicans are trying to change that equation. And the AFL-CIO and some of the other labor unions, since 2000, prior to 2000, they were opposed to illegal immigration. You know, Cesar Chavez actually led a march with Walter Mondale down to the Mexican border against illegal immigration because he saw it as competing with the United Farm Workers Union. But in 2000, a lot of the unions changed their position and said, okay, we're going to embrace people who are in this country illegally and argue that they should become legal immigrants because they think that they're going to become members of the union. And in some cases, they do. I mean, for the unions, Service International Employees Union, for example, that represents hotel workers, there's a great opportunity for growth here. But I think ultimately down the road this thing is going to bite them in the butt. I think the Republicans are so good at this, and the Democrats think that they've got something here that they're going to win with, and I just fear that that it's really going to whack them. Trish, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Dara in Felton, Delaware. Hey, Dara.
Hi, it's good to talk to you again. Thank you. Okay. I was listening to Sherrod Brown last night on the on C-SPAN,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that he said was that if anybody wants to deal with the immigration issue, the first thing they're going to have to deal with is the trade issue.
Yeah, that was my point. And there's these three pieces to it, and that's the first part of it.
But the other thing he said is that I agree with him on this, is that these guys in D.C., especially the corporate Democrats, basically, are sitting in a free trade echo chamber.
Yep.
I'm hoping that he can get in there. I'm worried because I'm from Ohio originally, Ohio has always had crooked elections, but nothing like this.
Yeah. Well, I'm really impressed to hear Sherrod Brown talking like that. I knew that he was a fairly progressive Democrat, but I'm impressed. He's been on this program a couple of times. But you just never know when the rubber hits the road. It's one thing to talk to a liberal talk show host. It's another thing to be on C-SPAN and be saying those things. That's great.
He can do that, and if the rest of them can get there, I think the Democrats have a shot.
Yeah, and I think the Democrats are waking up, and the thing that's waking them up is you and me. It's the fact that they're hearing from their constituents. Dara, thank you for the call, and thank you for listening to the program. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with a report from the Talk Radio News Service. We'll find out what's happening in Washington, D.C. today, right after the break. And then we're going to have a Taking Our Country Back segment for you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change here in America. Gail Jacobson is with us. Gail is a concerned citizen is it San Diego County? Gail?
Hello?
Hey, Gail.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. I can. Hey, Gail.
Hi. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you for being with us. You're a concerned citizen in what county is that?
San Diego County.
Okay, great. And you got involved with the San Diego County Registrar over the Busby election. Tell us about that.
Yes. I was very concerned. Excuse me. I was very concerned because I had heard after the election that some poll workers were allowed to take home electronic voting machines. And I had also been reading about problems with these machines and how it would be very easily be compromised.
Okay.
And so because of that, I got involved with this.
And what did you do?
Excuse me?
What did you do?
Well, I'm working with another group of concerned citizens, and we felt that we really had to get some information about the chain of custody of these machines. And we wanted to make sure that the actual election totals were correct. So we decided to file some information requests. And so initially we filed for a 1% audit and also some information about how many people actually came to the polls. And when we did not get any response back and we were told that it would take a long time before we got that, we became very concerned and we decided to submit a letter for a manual hand count under the recount provisions of California.
Now, this is to Michael Haas, the San Diego County Registrar, this is who you're corresponding with?
Yes, we're corresponding with the Registrar of Voters. Mr. Michael Haas, that's correct.
And it sounds like, you know, to boil this down to simple language, A, you're getting the runaround, and B, when they finally said, okay, fine, you can file for a recount, they said it's going to cost you an arm and a leg compared to what the same recount cost down in Orange County just a while ago.
That's correct. In fact, the letter that I sent was very specific. We felt that in order to begin a recount, the right that I have as a requester, I can choose which precincts I would like to start with first. In order to know which precincts you want to start with, because in the 50th there are 500, we need to take a look at various data. We wanted to look at the audit logs for the computers. We wanted to see what the chain of custody was for the various different computers in the different precincts. And we also wanted to find out information about how absentee ballots were actually counted,
handled,
which
yeah.
ones were rejected.
And all of this is because they quoted you a dollar a vote to recount this, whereas down in Orange County just did a hand recount at 14 cents a vote.
That's correct. In fact, in Orange County, they counted over 98,000 votes. They processed 15,000 ballots a day. The total amount was $14,000. Whereas our registrar was telling us that it could take 24 or more days, possibly to 30 days, they would only be able to process 6,000 votes a day. This was actually before I submitted the recount. Another concerned voter had sent an email to Mr. Haas, and he had said that this was possibly what it would cost.
Yeah. Gail, we're talking with Gail Jacobson, a concerned citizen in San Diego County. Gail, we only have a minute or so left. If citizens around the United States want to get involved in helping you out or in simply saying to San Diego County Registrar Michael Haas, hey, what's the deal here? Why don't you just recount the damn election? What do they do?
Well, I think that in California they should call his office, and also they should call the Secretary of State, because actually the Registrar of Voters need to be told by the Secretary of State that they need to follow certain guidelines, especially in regard to these electronic voting machines.
Do you happen to have either of those phone numbers handy?
Well, Mr. Haas's phone number, at least the main number, is 858-565-5800. And in terms of the Secretary of State's office, I think if you do a Google search, you'll find that, and there should be I would ask for the portion of the Secretary of State's office that deals with elections.
Okay, I didn't have a pen in my hand. Give me Michael Haas's phone number one more time.
Okay, it's 858-565-5800.
Okay.
The most important thing is that Mr. Haas did not respond to our request for information. He just gave us a very generic, well, we're gathering information. We may give you some information, but you have to pay $6,000 first. And then again, I just want to reiterate.
Did you pay the $6,000?
No, we did not, because this money is not just my money. This money is money that is being collected from concerned citizens, and we felt in good faith we could not give that money without knowing exactly what we were going to be getting for it, because the following day we'd have to pay another $6,000.
Right, and so basically you're being stonewalled here.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Michael Haas's phone number, 858-565-5800. And Gail Jacobson, concerned citizen in San Diego County. Gail, thanks for being on the program. Thanks, most importantly, for becoming an activist, for getting out there and doing something.
Thank you.
Good on you.
Thank you for what you're doing, too. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Hello.
Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bounced Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends. We're taking our country back, and we're doing it one congressional district at a time. We had asked, one of our callers had asked Bernie Sanders sometime back, you know, what's the best, I've got $25, what's the best thing I can do with it? Should I send it to the DNC, the DLC, the DCCC? He said, no, find a good candidate, a candidate you can believe in, and if all the candidates in your area are just fine with you, find a candidate outside your own area and send them $25 or $50 or $100 or volunteer to help their campaign or whatever. But you get out there and get involved. So that's what we're doing. Our Taking My Country Back segment. Our candidate for today is, am I pronouncing this right, Kimon Kotos?
Kotos.
Kimon Kotos. K-I-M-O-N-K-O-T-O-S. And Kimon, you're running for, and the website is Kotos, K-O-T-O-S, for forcongress.com, and running for Congress in Michigan's 2nd District, right?
Thank you. Yes, Tom. It's great to hear from you. I'm running against Congressman Peter Hoekstra, head of the House Intelligence Committee, and I'm really running to represent the people of West Michigan.
You in Newego is in your area.
Newego's in my area, yeah.
Hey, that's where I used to spend my summers. It's where my father grew up. It's where my grandparents are from, and I've got all kinds of family in Newego and in Kent County and all around there. Anyhow, it's great. So Kimon, right?
Yes.
Kimon. Tell us, why should, I guess the people who listen to this program regularly know Pete Hoekstra has become a little nutty here. He's, we found WMD. Yes, indeed. Nothing to worry about. But he is a fairly powerful Republican. Why should people in the 2nd District of Michigan throw out a Republican incumbent, and I'm assuming you're running as a Democrat?
Absolutely.
Okay, and bring in the Democrat, and bring in the Democratic candidate.
Well, we need someone here who will invest in the people in West Michigan and try to attract jobs and give value to who we are as a district. You know, we have some of the best environment in Western Michigan. We have great sustainable agricultural programs going on with organic farmers. We're known for our fruit production. We have a history of skilled labor here. We actually are starting to lead the way in terms of advanced technology with photovoltaics and nickel hydride batteries. And we're moving ahead, and we need to make our place here, but we've been forgotten by Pete Hoekstra. After 14 years, Pete has gotten more and more loyal to defending Bush's war and forgotten about our losing jobs rapidly out the door to Mexico, China, and India. And the effect that that's having on the workers here in Michigan is devastating, and we need to turn that around.
So Kimon Kotos, KOTOSFORCongress.com, the website. What would you do? How would you change this hemorrhaging of jobs that Michigan and other parts of the United States are experiencing?
Well, first of all, we need to attract the business investment and let them know that there are people who have a history of producing successful goods and services here, and that this is a plus, this is an asset. I'm joining along with Governor Granholm to promote Michigan's advancing technological and work and life sciences to show that we are leading the way. Michigan has been at the bottom of the rank for the last 2 years or more, losing jobs, and we have a chance to make sure that the people here have a future. Now, one of the things I would do is I would be seeking to be on the Education and Workforce Committee and the Agriculture Committee to try and find funding sources for that. But it's also important to let people know that we have the advantage of our location here to really make a difference in spurring the economy for all of Michigan and the greater Midwest area.
Kimon, NAFTA.
Disaster.
What disaster? Okay, thank you. Healthcare. What's your position on healthcare?
I support single-payer universal health care, and I fought for that even when I lived in California. It's way overdue, and there's too many people who are putting off taking care of their health, and the cost of deferred maintenance and not having access is really devastating to our country.
So, yeah, well said. The national budget and fair taxation, these are really serious issues here. Bush has run up over $3 trillion in debt in the 5 years he's been in office. It's money that our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay. He's imposed a birth tax on every child born in the Michigan Second District, as well as everywhere else in the United States, of almost over $27,000 you owe the moment you're born. What would you do about that?
Well, first of all, I would try to make sure we can pay down the debt and start changing the tax laws that the Republican Congress has enacted during the Bush regime. You know, you just said it right now. We're $3 trillion in debt just this year. You know, Bush is talking about how he's reduced the deficit in half to, what, $300 billion? Well, we're already paying $172 billion on the Social Security surplus, plus over $300 billion on the interest on the debt. So these guys are just running up the debt and putting us at risk. We have to make sure we protect the Social Security, but not by privatizing. We have to make sure we stop spending money on the defense budget and start investing it in the people and the services that we need here in the United States.
Although I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're in favor of the United States having a strong defense.
Oh, that's true. But, you know, we've gone from around a little over $300 billion to well over $500 billion in defense to promote this war. And what we've done is we've really sacrificed the people in this country, not to mention the devastation that has happened because of the war.
This is, in my opinion, in some very real ways, weakened the United States of America.
I agree.
If Kim and say your last name again for me.
CODIS.
CODIS, thank you. Kim and CODIS. How can people get involved with your campaign? What are you looking for right now?
Well, I want people nationwide to realize that Pete Hoekstra is a target. He represents the Bush administration's effort to undermine the Constitution, to divert money to corporations that are needed for helping to balance the budget and support investment in this country. We have to start putting the needs of the American people first because we're putting our people at risk. In this district, we've lost a tremendous amount of factory jobs and manufacturing, and the effect that that's having on those forgotten American workers is just unacceptable. So what I want people to do is help to get online. I sure could use some help with contributions, but we need to stir up some noise that this second district needs to be an important part of the equation changing the Republican Congress.
Well, our signal reaches into the 2nd District, both on Sirius Satellite Radio and on WTKG in Grand Rapids, a clear channel station there that reaches into your district.
Right.
Do you want people, are you looking for volunteers, for example? People
absolutely.
To go door to door and hand out stuff, things like that.
Yes, I'm looking for volunteers to come and get involved with handing out literature, putting up yard signs, putting up bumper stickers, but even more so talking to their neighbors and making sure that people get out and vote. That's one of the things that's really hurt us is the apathy because people felt so let down here in West Michigan. They need to be inspired to go out and vote because they can change the outcome.
Am I correct in assuming that the Democratic primary is over and you're definitely the candidate who's going to be running against Pete Hoekstra?
Well, the Democratic primary is August the 8th, but I am the candidate, and I ran 2 years ago. So I've been doing an ongoing campaign to mobilize people and build coalitions from faith, environmental, energy, renewable energy, union workers, the civil rights community, and teachers. I mean, I've really been reaching out on a regular basis on a tireless effort, and it's wonderful. I've gained so much. I've learned a lot from the people here, and I know that they want to make a difference, but they've been, you know, when I first ran here, nobody wanted to run against Pete Hoekstra because they felt they couldn't beat him because of the Christian right element in Ottawa.
Well, and also just beating an incumbent is a tough thing, period.
Absolutely.
Regardless of the party affiliate, even beating a corrupt incumbent is a tough thing. Here we have, we're talking with Kim and CODIS. He's the Democrat who's going to be running against Pete Hoekstra in the 2nd District of Michigan. His website, CODIS, K-O-T-O-S, forcongress.com. And you can check out the website. Kimmon, is the Democratic Party or the Democratic Congressional, the DCCC, are they giving you any help?
Really not a lot. I mean, they're waiting to see how much money I produce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're maybe waiting to see if anything breaks with Hoekstra. But, you know, I've been out here helping the Democratic Party for the last 12 years, starting in Flint, Michigan, in my hometown. I left California to come out there and help Dale Kildee, who was my mentor, And I've been mobilizing and going door to door. I've been a campaign manager and worked in Pennsylvania, worked for Mark Warner. I was the national field director for Dennis Kucinich. I've been going tirelessly, and I actually asked them, what can you do for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, you got a great plan, but unless you've got $200,000, we're not going to take you that seriously. Well, I think they have a responsibility to take all these Republicans into consideration and change the outcome of the Congress so that the Democrats are in charge. Because Pete Hoekstra doesn't own the seat, but there are people here who are suffering, and they need someone to fight for them, and that's one of the reasons why I'm doing it.
And I speak with some knowledge of that. As I said, you know, as a kid, I picked apples up there in White Cloud. I mean, I take, you know, I half my good chunk of my life anyway. I spent in the Michigan 2nd District, and or at least my childhood. And I wish you the very best.
I appreciate that.
Kim and Kotos, KOTOS, forcongress.com. Check out the website right now. If you can help out, it would be much appreciated. Good luck to you, Kim.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for being with us on the program today. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Take a year, shout it out and hope someone hears. Just ignore it and drink a beer. Don't believe the hype, don't fight the fear. She's a terrible mother, that Britney Spears. Must we remind you, it's election year.
Yeah, let's save the internet. Contact your member of Congress today. You can call your House, your member of the House of Representatives, or your both of your senators. You have one congressman or one congresswoman, and you have two senators, and you can reach Capitol Hill to speak to any of them at 888, toll free, 888-355-3588, and tell them to support net neutrality. Now, it's already gone down in flames in the House. The vote's going to be coming up in the Senate. So I strongly encourage you to call your senators and say, please, please support net neutrality. We do not want corporations deciding at which speed what websites can move through the Internet. The Internet needs to be neutral territory, and it needs to stay that way. David Poole, our producer here, called San Diego County Registrar Michael Haas, who, after our conversation with Gail Jacobson a few minutes ago, and was going to call and ask permission to record a brief conversation with Mr. Haas, give him an opportunity to tell his side of the story so that we could put it on the air. And this was, you know, no attempt to ambush him or anything like that, which is pretty straightforward. We'll put you on the air and have a conversation with you. David, what happened when you called 858-565-5800, Michael Haas, the San Diego County Registrar of Voters phone number?
Well, they transferred me to his secretary, and then she took my name and whatnot and put me on hold for a minute, and then came back and said that Mr. Haas would not be able to talk to me today, and then I could try back tomorrow if I'd like.
Did you get the feeling that this was a...
It's a brush-off.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
You identified yourself as being with this radio program?
Producer of the Tom Hartman National Radio Program.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
And so, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe individual citizens he'll talk to. Maybe citizens of, maybe voters in San Diego County he'll talk to. If you live in San Diego County, if you live in California, give it a shot. You could try. I mean, his phone number is 858-565-5800. Or you can call the Secretary of State and ask the Secretary of State, hey, what's going on with this guy? What's going on with San Diego County? Is there something strange going on there? Is there something that we need to know about? I mean, is this, is there, you know, well, what's the deal? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States. Jeff in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jeff.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
Good, Tom. Anyway, I want to make a sarcastic suggestion for all the progressive voters to just avoid the November elections and to stay home as a protest for all this cheating that's happening.
Good one, Jeff. Good one. You know, that is essentially the message that I think a lot of Republicans want Democrats to hear is, oh, yeah, the machines are rigged. Your vote doesn't count. Just don't show up. And the other thing that's really strange is, you know, there was a big push for people who are afraid of voting machines. They were using absentee ballots. They said, give me an absentee ballot. And, for example, the Busby Billray race, the race was called before those ballots were even opened. So
that's
it's a real catch-22 for folks who don't trust a machine owned by a private corporation that operates in secret. And yet they want to make sure that their vote is counted.
Okay. Well, on the absentee ballot time thing, it's the Democrats that don't want you to use that in California anyway.
But, right. That was my point.
But
and I yeah. think they're making a mistake when they do that. But here's the question for you, Jeff. You're a Republican, right?
Yes.
Okay. Here's my question for you. Are you going to feel safe voting on a voting machine that is owned by the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, or a political ally of his?
Well, in my county, we don't have Diebold, so that doesn't matter.
No, I'm not talking about Diebold. I'm talking about Sequoia. Sequoia machines are in use in California, and that company is owned by political allies of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Are you going to feel comfortable voting on those machines?
If the Secretary of State checks them out and reviews them and certifies them, yes. See, I do call, and I have talked to San Diego about this, and see what bothers me about all this talk on the progressive radio station is, number one, I do listen to many of you, and I have heard people call in that said they didn't vote because they were discouraged, and that's wrong, too.
That's wrong. That's on either side, frankly. Aren't you concerned about the fact that these voting machines, these Diebold voting machines in Sacramento, in San Diego, went home overnight, in some cases for weeks at a time, where, you know, they were, like, stored in somebody's kid's, you know, bedroom where the kid is a computer whiz?
Well, that may have happened in 2004, and when I challenged Brad...
No, we're talking about the primary a few weeks ago.
No, that's what I mean. The information that's being used to indicate that was, and Brad brought up a news article in 2004. This current election, they went home because the precincts had to be transported too far and it's too hard to do it. So they didn't take it home overnight. And because of the problem that they are worried about, the machines were triple sealed and could not be opened until all the precinct workers are present to see that it's still sealed.
Yeah. Well, so, let's hope that you're right, Jeff. I would be so reassured, you know, and I thank you for the call. It's always great to hear from Republicans on this program. I would be so reassured to know that our elections are safe. But the big question in my mind is, why are we allowing private for-profit corporations to record our votes, tabulate our votes, do it in secret, and then tell us who we voted for? Where did this crazy idea come from? 57 minutes past the hour.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Rob Ritchie is with us. He's the executive director of Fair Vote, fairvote.org, the website, the Center for Voting and Democracy. Rob, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The issue of voting, in fact, in the last hour, we were talking about the issue of voting in San Diego County and, you know, voting machines and is the vote safe and is it competent? But really there's a larger issue here that has to do with democracy, the nature of democracy in the United States and how we vote. Give me your take on this.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it does start with that basic protection of the right to vote, the security of the right to vote, which we do not have securely affirmed in the U.S. Constitution. So I think that's one of the changes that we want to see is affirmation of the right to vote in the Constitution, putting it right up there with the right to free speech and the other rights and the Bill of Rights. And
the right to own guns.
Yeah, right.
If you have the right to own a gun, you should have the right to vote, right?
Yeah, and back 200 years ago, they didn't see it that way. And, you know, many people were denied the right to vote, and so it was left to states to make a lot of decisions, and they in turn left it to counties, and we have, you know, more than 13,000 jurisdictions making these independent decisions, not always very wise or fair about the right to vote. But that is I think indicative of ways we think about the right to vote and even think about some first principles. And what I want to make sure we get in today is what's going on out there to affirm the idea that our winners of governor and when we have one person representing us, that person win a majority of 50% plus one, and that can be achieved better than the way we usually do it through instant runoff voting, and there's some great campaigns developing.
Right, and this is a concept that, you know, some people, when people get it, they get it, and when they don't get it, they get really confused. And, you know, people of goodwill, the problem that we have is that because we have first-past-the-post winner-take-all elections, in other words, if two people are running, whoever, you know, and they're the only two people running, one gets 51%, the other gets 49%, then you could argue that there's a democratic outcome because that person we know represents more than half the electorate. So that's, you know, in a democracy, it's a democratic republic. We'll tip our hat to the semanticists among us, but nonetheless, in a democracy, within the restraints of the protection of the rights of minorities, the majority rules. And so if only two people are running, you can have a democratic outcome. In fact, usually you do. But if three people are running, it's extremely unlikely that you're going to have a democratic outcome. In fact, the odds are it's a virtual certainty that the person who ends up getting elected is going to be somebody who doesn't represent 51% of the electorate. So the two ways that this has been addressed historically, one is proportional representation, which John Stuart Mill came up with back in the 1860s, and which most countries have adopted, where you don't vote for the person, you vote for the party, and if the party gets 20% of the vote, they get 20% of the seats in parliament, and if they get 30%, another party gets 30%, they get 30% of the seats, and then they put their people in, and then they form coalitions, and that's why you have all these different parties in, for example, Israel or in Germany, you know, that kind of thing. But we couldn't do that here in the United States. That would require a massive amendment of the United States Constitution, virtually a rewrite of the U.S. Constitution. So instead, what we're looking at, what you're proposing, is a variation on what Australia and New Zealand did to solve this problem, which is instant runoff voting. So describe for us how instant runoff voting would work. Let's just pick an election, a for example election. Let's take one where there were multiple candidates, like the 2000 election, where we had Al Gore, we had
Bush.
Yeah, that's the one I'm having a mental blank on, and Ralph Nader. And in addition to
Ralph Nader. Right. One quick, you know, I like that setup to the question. One thing I did want to highlight is a couple of the campaigns that are going on this year that feature the same kind of ballot that we'll be about to talk about with instant runoff voting are actually proportional voting methods, and that there are candidate-based versions of proportional voting with a real history in the United States. That speak very powerfully to hold debates about redistricting and fair representation, and that they do not require constitutional change, and that are candidate based. So I just
how do those work?
Flag that. Well, actually, maybe let's first get into instant runoff voting.
Yeah, in fact, maybe we can talk about that in another conversation.
How kind of it? There's a variant of it
because we only have 4 minutes here left.
Okay, great. Well, so everyone, many people have engaged with a campaign where more than two people are running. And one of these candidates, typically a third-party candidate like a Ralph Nader or a Ross Perot, is being described as a spoiler, that they can't win, but they're running, and they're just going to split the majority and permit someone to win who doesn't have majority support. And that's a product of using a first-past-the-post plurality system where you vote for one and whoever has the most votes wins no matter what they have. And you're right that the system breaks down when you have this shocking development of more than two people run, whether it's a primary or a general election, a city election, and so on. And instant runoff says, well, you know, you can actually generate a majority winner in one round just by allowing voters to provide more information. And the voters already have this information to provide, and you just need to have a ballot that allows them to do it. And all you need to do is to allow them to say, here's my first choice, but also, here's my second choice. And actually, I'll go ahead and express a third choice, too. Candidates being able to rank choices 1, 2, 3. So if you look at that 2000 election, if I was wanting to vote for Pat Buchanan or Ralph Nader, I would vote for them, and I would vote for them enthusiastically if I liked them, and that would be my first choice. But if I thought, you know, that they might not be in the top two, they might not be the strongest candidate, I would also go ahead and rank a second choice. And then you would add up all the first choices, and if anyone has a majority, you're done, because you have a majority winner.
Right, but so let's say your first choice was Pat Buchanan, and your second choice would have been probably George Bush if you were a Pat Buchanan supporter.
Right.
And so you voted number one for Pat Buchanan and number two for George W. Bush. The vote is counted, and nobody got over 50% of the vote.
Exactly.
And
that's what happened in Florida, say, right? So in Florida, you know, it was really close between Bush and Gore, but no one had 50%. If we'd been using instant runoff voting in Florida, the people who had voted for Nader and Buchanan would have been able to list that second choice, and presumably most Buchanan people would have listed Bush second, and most Nader people would have listed Gore second. And then so you would have had the top two, you know, the strongest candidates move into the next round of counting, and then the weak candidates would be taken out of the race because they'd lost, but their ballots would still be able to count. They'd count now for their second choice. So you'd have a second round of counting where everyone's ballot counts again, and if your candidate's one of the top two, you're happy because your ballot counts for your first choice. And if your first choice candidate's not in the race, like if you're a Buchanan person, it counts for your second choice. So you add up all the votes, and then you get a majority winner. And that's all there is to it.
So in this case, your Buchanan first choice, Bush second choice, once it was ascertained that there was no 50%, nobody had 50% of the vote, they'd look at the top two folks, and of course that was Gore and Bush. They, between the two of them, got the majority of the votes. And so your Buchanan vote would be dropped, but your ballot is still counted, and since you had a second choice for Bush, your vote now becomes a Bush vote.
Exactly, and if you're a Nader person, your ballot probably will become a Gore vote.
Right.
Because if it had only been two candidates, what you're trying to simulate is if the field had only been two, who would have won?
Right.
And instant runoff gives us a chance to determine that. And so the result of that is, well, you get a majority winner, which is what we obviously want to see, and you can have a full-fledged opportunity to run, even if you might not win, and people can look at your candidacy in a much more positive way. Like, what are you bringing into politics? What are the new ideas you have?
Right. Now, Rob Ritchie, the executive director of Fair Vote, fairvote.org, in a chat room, Tahoe Kevin says, lesser of two evils still leaves you with evil. My response to that would be, in instant runoff voting, you now have opened it up for third, fourth, fifth party candidates to actually participate, actually have a voice, speak out as loudly as they want. People get enthusiastically behind them because people are no longer afraid that those candidates are going to act as spoilers and hurt their own best interests.
Right.
And this actually would diminish the evil, as it were, in the system. Am I right in that?
Absolutely. I mean, if people don't like the candidates, someone else can be running and they're not just a spoiler. So if the major party candidates really are not the kind of candidates that a certain number of people want, there's very likely to be a candidate sort of stepping into that vacuum. And if they're truly, you know, popular, they can win. I mean, because
in 2000, I actually did vote for Ralph Nader, but I didn't get out and campaign for him. But had I known that if he didn't make it, my vote would have gone for Al Gore, I could have gone out and aggressively campaigned for him and said, hey, you know, get out there and vote for, knowing that most people who are on, you know, were of the Nader mindset in 2000 would pick Gore as their second choice, and that would ultimately become their vote if it came to that. But over time, you're really opening the system up.
But, right, and it's working well where it's being used in cities, and there's four cities that are likely to vote on it this November, including some big ones. So about 1.5 million voters are going to have a crack at instant runoff voting this
year. That's wonderful. So you want to learn more about it, go to the Center for Voting and Democracy. Fairvote.org is the website. Rob Ritchie, the executive director. Rob, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. I hope we can stay in touch on this one.
Indeed. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
My kids don't read and my kids don't write. I'm stuck in a traffic jam every night. The crime rate's up, but that's all right, 'cause I got low taxes.
Oh, I'd agree.
Low taxes like they have in Mississippi. Low taxes, that's what I live for. Low taxes. You bet your sweet Bibby, I hear those low taxes singing my song.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Let's see. The Middle East is in flames. Gold is up above 655 right now. The stock market collapsing around us. Bush can't figure out which way, where he's going, what he's doing. The Think Progress and Air America radio websites were both down this morning. Everything seems to be disintegrating. It must be that Mercury is retrograde. I'm looking at this morning going, I think this is some kind of right-wing conspiracy. And David Poole goes, nah, Mercury's retrograde. And it's there you go. Anyhow, Victoria Jones, our Common Article 3 senior correspondent from Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line, live from Washington, D.C., assuming that the phone is still working. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, but you know, Mercury actually is retrograde.
I know. It's retrograde until the 24th, I think, or the
27th. Yeah, I know. It sucks.
it happens, what, three times a year, more or less?
Yeah. It's bad. The thing, mail doesn't arrive, and, oh, everything goes wrong.
Anything that can, that will, yeah.
Yeah.
Although they say that, I know nothing about astrology except for this, and I learned this from one of my publishers who actually will not sign a contract when Mercury is retrograde, and more often than not won't answer his phone. He lets everything go into voicemail during those 3 weeks that Mercury is retrograde. He said that it's actually a good time. There's a positive side to it, and that is that when Mercury is retrograde, that's when you go within. It's a time for, you know, contemplation, meditation, quiet thinking, reflection, discussion, planning, plotting, scheming, those kinds of things. And then you get active once Mercury goes direct. So that's everything I know.
So I can't carry out any of my schemes until, what, the 25th, basically?
I think, yeah. I'd have to look on the Mercury retrograde website to get the exact date.
But not now.
Right, pretty much all of July. I think it
went. Yeah, July's a write-off. Okay.
Yeah, went retrograde on the 2nd. So,
yeah,
so what's Common Article 3? Tell me about this.
Common Article 3.
We discussed this yesterday.
Well, we're going to be discussing it again because in Congress all week long they're having these hearings. You know, the Senate Judiciary, the House Armed Services, and today it was the Senate Armed Services Committee having hearings on what to do with the Guantanamo Bay refugees, detainees. This is the last of three hearings, although they've threatened to have more. And I think I saw sighs, groans, and shaking of the heads from the senators, but I can't be sure about that. Basically, they were asking very senior JAG officers, well, senior, the head of the Army, Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines, as well as a couple of retired ones, where do we go from here? What do we do? Now, yesterday and Tuesday, I felt the witnesses were stacked in favor of the administration, and they were basically saying, we need to sign off on what the president's done. The president is always right. You played that wonderful clip.
Right.
And that's what they were saying. Today was very different. I mean, these are, you know, judge, advocates, general. These are the guys actually in the legal field. They all said, all of them said that we need something different. They all felt that we need something in between a flat-out court-martial and what Bush has got. They all want laws of evidence. None of them want anything like this. Every single one of them had a severe problem with what's being done now.
Interesting.
Which was very, very encouraging. The only people who didn't have a problem, seemed to have a problem with it, were Senator Inhofe, Senator Sessions, and Senator Pat Roberts.
Interesting. Pat Roberts, of course, famous for standing up and speaking out and then sitting down and shutting up.
Right, exactly.
It's amazing how many times he's, what, they're spying on us? Oh, gee, okay.
It's just
absolutely mind-boggling to me. By the way, when we refer to Guantanamo Bay, I just looked up the word concentration, the phrase concentration camp, on the Merriam-Webster online dictionary.
Yes.
And it is not a pejorative. It is not a negative term. It's simply a noun. It's a two-word noun, a camp where persons as prisoners of war, political prisoners, or refugees are detained or confined. So I'm going to start suggesting that, you know, just like I, you know, like we shouldn't be saying illegal immigrant, we should be saying illegal employers, that instead of saying the Guantanamo Bay camp, we should be calling it the Guantanamo Bay concentration camp, because according to Merriam-Webster dictionary, that's what it is.
You go for it, Tom.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to hearing you ask, Tony Snow, Tony, about the concentration camps at Guantanamo Bay.
Oh, that's gonna happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really gonna happen.
Yeah. Okay. I'm curious. How do you know what you were just sharing with us, by the way?
How do I know? Because I just sat through 3.5 hours of it.
Oh my goodness.
I was in the room, sitting there, furiously blackberrying quotes to my colleagues and telling them what was going on and giving them all the color background, i.e. John Warner wore an electric blue tie that was not becoming, and Hillary Clinton was wearing a gold-colored suit that brought out the blonde in her hair.
All this going to go, though, Victoria Jones? Do you think that something – it seems like there's a consensus that something's going to be done, or
There was certainly a consensus on this committee that something is going to be done, that legislation will be written, and that it will be workable.
They're going to create, and are they going to just deport all these folks off to Afghanistan or something?
No, they're not. I think they want to try them.
Interesting. Victoria Jones, our Common Article 3 correspondent with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us
today. Thank
you. Always good talking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Mercury goes direct on the 29th, by the way.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We gotta take the power back. We gotta take the power back.
Indeed, my friends, we've got to take the power back, and the way we do it is by getting out there and getting active. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the No Despair Zone. Welcome back to our program. 34 minutes past the hour, unless I already said that, in which case it still is. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thank you and your staff for your hard work. What's on my mind is you had mentioned earlier in the program about a British banker killing himself or being killed. He was involved, or he was accused anyway, of stealing about $20 million, him and two others, from selling Enron stock ahead of time. And the point of this is that the UK-US extradition law, it's a law in England. It was passed as an act. But in our country, it hasn't been passed. It's still in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Your people and yourself last November helped keep it from becoming a law and getting
your people? Which your people are you talking about?
Well, the people who are concerned about our Constitution. I mean, this is an attack on our Constitution.
The extradition treaty.
Yes. What happens is, and this is why the guy killed himself, if the British were to accuse an American of breaking a British law, they would not have any access to court or a lawyer. They would be extradited depending on what the executive branch decided was a good or bad extradition treaty. It would become a political football. And this affects our Constitution.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a good... I mean, there are reasons for extradition treaties and there are reasons against them. And the one that you just explained is a good one. For example, if we had an extradition treaty with Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis decided that because I have a glass of wine tonight, I have violated Sharia law, or, you know, that you ate some bacon.
Exactly right.
They could extradite us to Saudi Arabia, where we could face the death sentence for blasphemy.
And not only that, it's retroactive. It can go back 20 years, so you can have old scores being. So there's a meeting. There's the next Wednesday, July 19th. the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is going to have a hearing on it. When you when we stopped it last November, they said they would have a hearing sometime in 06. This is the hearing, and they just brought it up day before yesterday and yesterday. So there's not a lot of time, but if
this
people
is the Senate.
call their senators.
Well, now, hang on just a second here. Now, we're talking with Jim in Pittsburgh, and Jim, there is also, and similarly, you were talking about UK law. For example, in the United States, I can say, Tom DeLay is scum, and I mean, it's not the kind of thing that I would typically say, but I could say that, and there are no penalties to me saying that because he's a public figure. I mean, just like he could say that I am because I'm a public figure. Whereas if I said, if I knew your last name and I were to say that you were, you could actually, although the fact that you're on the radio with me, you've exposed yourself to the public, but let's say, you know, we never had, you're a private figure. If I were to say that, you could sue me for libel. You know, for essentially calling you a name. In the United Kingdom, there are no protections for public figures.
Absolutely.
So it's fairly routine for politicians to sue newspapers and reporters who write things about them that are unflattering. And so a UK newspaper could, or a person in the UK, if anybody, you know, if I said something about Tony Blair, then he could sue me and he could have me extradited, even though what I said was legal here in the United States. It would be illegal to say the exact same thing in the UK. So that's the downside of extradition treaties. But here's the flip side of it. What if there's a guy in the United States who, let's say, goes to your house, Jim, and, you know, murders every member of your family with a butcher knife, and then, that, you know, it successfully escapes the house, ties you up, you're tied up and stuffed in the closet, you know, cleans himself up, escapes the house, gets on a plane and flies over to England, and he's sitting in a hotel in England. Now, do you want to have the ability to have him extradited back to the United States?
Yes, but I want it to be done under judicial law. I want it to be under our Constitution to give him his rights, but I want the son of a bee to die.
Well, see, now, because you're really upset about his having committed a crime here. Now, what if, on the other hand, this guy had, let's flip it around. Let's say that somebody comes from Saudi Arabia to the United States, and here in the United States they burn a Koran. Or somebody from the, you know, commits the ultimate blasphemous act. It's not illegal under U.S. law to burn the Quran. It is illegal under Saudi law. Should Saudi Arabia be able to ask for the deportation of that guy?
That's the basic problem with this extradition treaty. The law, the way it is written, it is impermissibly vague, is what a lawyer said. But the vagueness of the laws are such that they can be construed to do anything that they want them to do.
On the other hand, what happens if a guy burns the Quran in Saudi Arabia and then hops on a plane and comes to the United States, and Saudi Arabia says, we want to extradite this guy because he committed a crime, and we say, hey, that's not a crime here.
But he's still entitled to judicial review and a lawyer.
Okay, so which, under what venue? Who's the, you know, judicial review by whom?
Well, if he's here, you have to presume that he's here legally enough to be deserving of due process.
So the due process is in the country that is where the person is resident at the moment, temporary
right.
resident.
Right, now, unless this treaty gets through, if Lugar and Biden can resist this, the Brits are sending over somebody next Wednesday to talk about it. Because, you know, the Brits are subjects. We are citizens. And we are citizens, and we have to fight for this Constitution. And if a treaty is written and it's detailed and it's specific, that's one thing. But when you write a vague, retroactive treaty that can be construed around by anybody, that's breaking our Bill of Rights, and that's attacking our Constitution.
I have to confess, Jim, I'm really unfamiliar with this, and I intend not to be by this time tomorrow, but and I appreciate the conversation. Is this a partisan issue? Is this something that Republicans are for or against, and Democrats are for or against?
No, I think, well, this was signed by Ashcroft in March of 2003, and it eventually went to the committee. We were told in the committee that it probably would never come out. It came out in November. We were able to stop it, and this hearing next Wednesday, hopefully the people will stop
it. Okay, you're in Pennsylvania. What are Santorum and...
Yes, and Santorum is not much help. Specter is much more help. Congressman here, Mike Doyle, has been a great deal of help.
Yeah.
But everybody's got to call these people. If Lugar and Biden can stop this, and Dodd and some of the others on the Foreign Relations Committee, but anybody in the Senate should have some input in it.
Right, because the Senate has to ratify treaties. Now, refresh my memory. Do treaties require ratification by both houses of Congress or
just the
Senate?
No, just the Senate.
Okay, that's what I thought it was. It's just like judges. And
Bush wants this treaty.
And Bush wants it. Now, are they promoting it under the rubric of this is going to help us win the war on terror?
Oh, sure. And the guy that got killed.
Why am I not surprised?
Yeah. The guy that killed himself or whatever in England, he was one of the three that were going to be extradited. And they fought it. But as I said before, it was passed as an act over there. So it's law. But now they're mad because they don't have the same access over here that we have with their people. And it's wrong that we have that access because the treaty didn't say we're going to get terrorists. So we're going to get criminals and anybody who breaks the law. And again, you get into that vagueness that the laws in England can be used against you as an American, even though you may have never left the United States, and there's no exact same law in the United States. They can call up and say, we accuse Tom Hartman of inciting riot because he objected to this and that and the other thing, and the judiciary, nothing to do with it, the executive branch, a bureaucrat would say, yes, I agree, that's right, Tom Hartman should be extradited, and you're on a plane, and you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have no recourse.
And they can take your house and everything because they say, well, this was fruit from the poison tree. And Tom Hartman got money in this show, and the show attacked us. Therefore, we're taking his house.
Right.
Honest to God, Tom, if you read this treaty, they make your
Okay, give me, Jim, any information that I can use to track this thing down with a Google search. Do you have, like a Senate bill number is there, or is it name of the treaty?
It's in the House Senate. I don't have a bill number right now, because I'm not sure the one that was there last year still applies.
Okay. Well, if you can get any information on it, drop me an email. We'll be looking for it, too. My email is tom@tomhartman.com, T-H-O-M, Tom, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, .com, okay?
I will, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Or Jim, excuse me. Good to hear from you. Interesting. Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, not much comes up to the level of that conversation.
That was pretty startling. I'm amazed that somehow that one slipped right underneath my radar.
Yeah.
Because not a whole lot does.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that goes on I firmly believe that time and travel has been invented, and Cheney and Rumsfeld and all those guys went back to feudal England, decided they like it, and now that's where they're taking us. But
yeah.
I wanted to talk about instant runoff.
Okay.
We do it up here in Burlington. It got us a third-party mayor this time. It's filtering down even into the elections in our union. But the only thing that I've been able to come up with that I don't know if it's good or bad. I haven't really thought it through yet. But, in traditional elections, when you have too many candidates, you end up with another election where some candidates say, I'm going to throw my support behind candidate X or Y.
Right.
And I think in terms of government, and I don't know whether it's good for government or good for the populace, that has a tendency to form some kind of coalition because those two people usually get together and strike some kind of deal about how they're going to put government together.
Yeah, that's what happens with proportional representation.
Right, and in instant runoff situations, that's excluded. Your candidate deal-making and coalition building.
Well, no, it's not. It just has to be filtered through you and me. What would happen, like right now, there is no majority party in Israel, for example. There's these coalitions. But what would happen here is, let's say, candidate, number nine out of nine decides he's going to drop out of the race, and he wants to throw his support to candidate number four. What he has to do is he has to go out in the public airwaves, or candidate number four can buy the time himself and say, candidate number nine has endorsed me. Please, if you're a candidate nine voter, vote for me instead.
And I guess that's the whole thinking through it process, but it seems to eliminate the business of forming some kind of a coalition after the initial election.
Which may actually be a good thing.
May or may not. I don't know if it's good or bad yet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one to think about. Bob, thanks for the call.
Sure.
It's the law of unintended consequences, right? But to the extent that we can take the smoke-filled rooms in the back of politics out of the equation, I think it's a good idea. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Goodbye, George. You gotta go. Me or my home. You're the scourge of all the folks on the bio. Please don't think you can tell one more lie. Son of a gun, what have you done to the bio? Jump alive, sitting by, come to twiddle. Louisiana floating by while you fiddle.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Huh? Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in broadcasting for a change here in the United States of America. Welcome back to our program, 1-866-440-8466. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Instant runoff voting. Well, right now we have the worst voting system possible. Plurality just is horrible. It's definitely better than we've got right now, but I think it's really overbuilt for what it delivers. There are much better systems such as range voting or approval. And, you know, one of the things, like with instant runoff voting, we need to look at is what are the results. And we unfortunately have a few places in the world that use it, such as Australia. And it's often, you know, touted as something that gets, you know, allows third-party candidates in. And perhaps it did that in Vermont, but if you look at Australia, it's still basically a two-party system. And
well, actually, the last time I was in Australia, I had a meeting with the president of the Democratic Party there, which is not like our Democratic Party. And it's actually the third or fourth party. It's the most liberal of the parties.
But they got like 10% of the vote in the last thing, where the others were the main
right.
Two
no,
parties.
No. I get that, but it was amazing. I mean, this guy, we spent several hours sitting and talking, he and a couple of his staff people, and what I got was they got 10% because of instant runoff voting. If it had not been because of instant runoff voting, they would have gotten 1%.
Yeah, but they still, if they've been doing it for a long time,
But they have the ability to influence elections. They have some push. They have some visibility. They're taken seriously because instant runoff voting allows them to participate. And the problem with that I see is that the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, neither one of them want instant runoff voting. They're fighting it tooth and nail in most areas because it's going to diminish their power.
Yeah, well, possibly. The thing is, again, the results aren't necessarily showing that. And the thing is, when compared to other methods that are in use right now, such as approval and range, which is actually an expanded version of approval, you get much, that's probably the most widely used voting thing around in the respect that's used all the time in surveys and so forth. It's shown that it works. And range, you get to score each candidate. You get to vote to give a qualitative score or a quantitative thing to each candidate. And so you get to vote on every single candidate. They all get compared.
Right, right.
And it works very well.
I understand and agree. I think, however, that it's a little more complex to explain, and B, you don't have as strong a movement pushing for it.
But the thing about instant runoff voting is there's a test called monotonicity, and it's probably pretty rare that it would fail it, but there's a thing where you can actually raise a candidate's vote and lessen the chances that candidate will actually win. There's also the thing it does not.
Depending on which round it happens in is how
well,
that
it
works
also
when you use it in multiple rounds.
When you deal with multiple candidates, instant runoff voting does not eliminate the throwaway vote.
Yeah.
It does not eliminate fear voting.
Right, and it doesn't eliminate a whole lot of problems. Jeff, we'll have to come back to this topic another time because I have to tell a story. I only have a minute and a half left here. Thank you very much for the call. We, after our conversation earlier in the program with, Barbara Gail Jacobson, who was trying to get San Diego County Registrar Michael Haas, phone number 858-565-5800, to respond to her and to actually recount the Busby Bill Ray race, because, for example, in one of these precincts, precinct 833, for example, which has 243 registered voters, there were 243 absentee votes. But there was a turnout of 4,173 voters in a district with only 243 registered votes, right? Voters, but they counted over 4,000 votes. So it's like, you know, she's like, "What's going on?" She's getting no answers. David Poole, my producer, was contacted by a whistleblower with some inside knowledge of this situation, and we have every reason to believe that this is legitimate, although there's a possibility it's not. And so I just throw that caveat on there, who suggested that the reason why the San Diego County Registrar and people around this issue in general in San Diego County are going to continue to stonewall and refuse to talk about these things is because the laws that are being broken, if laws are being broken, are federal laws and federal voting laws. And they have no concerns whatsoever, since a Republican was given the election, no concerns that the Bush administration, which controls the executive branch, runs the FBI, that the Bush administration will investigate it. They're quite confident that the Bush administration will not. and, in fact, for all practical purposes, wink and nod have been told. You know, just stonewall this long enough and it'll go away. And I'm wondering how many other districts, how many other, you know, voting districts around the United States, how many other people, registrars of voters, may have been given that message from the Bush administration. Well, you know, if you got some problems and it looks like maybe there's been a violation of the Voting Rights Act or there's been a violation of federal law, don't worry, because it's federal law, and we're the ones who decide whether or not to enforce it. For example, Ken Blackwell in Ohio. I mean, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. documented over and over all these, I mean, literally crimes that Ken Blackwell committed, and yet there's been no prosecution of him. Why? Because the Republicans control the FBI. I mean, they very much do. George Bush controls the apparatus. Same thing with the 2000 election in Florida. You got the ACLU trying to do civil lawsuits, but no, they're not doing anything. So the question, I guess, is, has Michael Haas, the San Diego County Registrar, broken federal law? And if so, will the feds hold him or his office accountable? And leave it to those of you who live in California to see if you can track that one down. Coming up tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, of course, will be with us, and John Dean, former legal counsel to President Richard Nixon, dropping by about his new book, Conservatives Without a Conscience. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.